Hello, everyone, and welcome. Welcome to Season 4 of the Power of Privilege and Allyship podcast. My name is Funke Abimbola, and I'm the CEO and founder of the Austin Bronte Consultancy, a global consulting firm whose main goal is to improve leadership by leveraging the impact of diversity, inclusion, belonging, and equity across the business world. My son, Max Abimbola, is co-host of the podcast with me, and he's a first-year computer science student at Newcastle University. Max normally interviews with me as much as he can, but he actually starts his exams today. So I think that's a fair enough excuse for him not to be joining me today in interviewing. But I do promise you all that Max will be back very, very soon. Now, today, I am so honoured to be interviewing Sarah Walker-Smith. Sarah, welcome to the podcast.
Oh, thank you so much. And I must say, I'm sending good luck vibes to Max as we speak.
Thank you. He's a bit concerned because it's the first set of exams for them all.
I know, so it's a big thing. And I'm disappointed not to meet him, but I'm sure he'll do well.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sarah. So Sarah, we're thrilled to have you on the podcast today. And I'd love you to introduce yourself to our audience, please, in your own words.
Thanks, Funke. Well, I'm the chief executive. If we want to talk about my job, I'll talk about me, the human being, in a second. But I'm the chief executive of a national law firm that we have recently turned into a professional services group. I originally was going to be an actress. I'm sure we'll come to this. I then became a chartered accountant, as you do. Worked my way through accountancy, worked at Boots the Chemist, ended up in the legal sector, and then ended up with the very strange accolade of being the first non-lawyer. I hate that phrase.
So do I.
The first non-lawyer chief exec and female chief exec of a national law firm, which is something that I'm both proud and horrified about in equal measure, because it shouldn't be so that I'm the only person doing this. And clearly I need to make sure that I leave a much better legacy.
I just, I always wonder why it is that solicitors are so comfortable with this non-lawyer label. I think it's abhorrent. I find it really, really shocking.
It's funny, and I've decided to speak out more about it because I'm fed up with it as well, actually. To describe somebody as a non-anything is really interesting, but it also shows you how incredibly insular the legal sector can be, because there is something like, I don't know, I'll get the number wrong, 100,000 lawyers, qualified solicitors in the UK. Maybe it's more than that. But there's also 67 million people. So to think that you're a non if you didn't get the qualification that a very small percentage got is just seeing the world through very different eyes. But it is a very tight culture. It's been a particular culture in the legal sector for a very long time. I have to say it is shifting dramatically and very quickly, thank goodness. So it's far less insular than it used to be. But we've still got some work to do.
We certainly do, Sarah. And I'm really intrigued about your career path because I wasn't aware of the actress aspirations. So do you want to talk us through that and your choices at school and the acting and everything else?
Yeah, so there's probably a few lessons in here somewhere as well. And I think the biggest one is don't get too stuck to a rigid plan, I suppose, really. But from a very, very young age, I was drawn to acting, even almost before I knew what it was. But it was more than just acting. It was writing stories, creating stories and acting them out, I suppose, really. And so from quite a young age, I was into that, but I didn't live in a family where they could support that. So I wasn't in the kind of family where I could go to ballet school or learn a musical instrument or do any of those things. So I used to do a lot of it for myself, and I organised clubs at school. I went to a pretty rough school in the middle of the biggest council estate in Lincoln. And I just used to organise the kids into drama clubs. It was just utterly innate that I wanted to bring people together to create drama or tell stories and sing and act and bring things to life like that. And of course, I was getting a lot of pressure from the school because I was reasonably academic to take my academic side more seriously. But I was quite stubborn about this, which was no, there is only one path for me. I'm going to be an actress and then I'm going to be a director and then I'm going to be a writer. So right the way through my school, that was the plan. I was very fortunate. I scrambled enough money together through a Saturday job to audition at one drama school, and that's all I could afford to do. And I got in, thankfully. And I also managed to get a place to do drama at uni, one of one place. You know, I think there were 14 places out of thousands of applicants. So I was incredibly fortunate to get it. And then on my 18th birthday, my mum asked me to leave home. So she was having a lot of mental illness issues, I suppose, not officially mental illness issues, but she was just going through a tough time. She asked me to leave home. I ended up living in a bedsit, and I realized that I wasn't quite ready to go and launch into drama. So I went to the careers office, asked them to what was the nearest job, and the job that they told me was an accountant, I think because they were going alphabetically through their filing system. So I said, fine, I'll defer my drama for a year, I'll go off and be an accountant, and the rest is history, really. So it was a bizarre thing. I was being pushed very heavily at school to go down the academic route and to go for an academic degree and all the rest of it. I was stubbornly following my own path, and then events overtook. And it just shows you that it doesn't always work out for the worst, does it? So
yes, I've certainly seen your acting ability on LinkedIn videos, Sarah. So I looked forward to those regular videos that you were doing. It's wonderful. Really, really good.
Well, I mean, that has taken me a bit of time, because what's happened, if I fast forward over the next kind of 40 years or 30 years ever since then, was I've kept the acting going because it's always been my love, and I've directed and I've written my own musical, having taught myself how to read and write music. And so I've kept that going, but I've kept the career going, and I've kept the two things completely separate. What I learned during lockdown and what you see on LinkedIn now is, why do I have two halves of me? I've put the two things together, and actually it's changed how I lead, and it's definitely changed how I communicate. And so I'm a big believer to try and find the silver linings from what happened in the pandemic. And for me personally, one of them is to stop having two halves of me and just have one person.
Yes, it certainly came across as real authenticity. You know, I remember we connected through LinkedIn. We've got a few professional colleagues in common. But when I saw that fun, creative side, I found it really attractive. I thought it was fabulous, actually. Well, make you a real person.
Well, exactly. And why not? And I've got the sign on my wall at the back of my shed here where I work saying why not? Because that's what I realized. What was stopping me? You can be a leader or an industry thought leader or a senior person who has to be extremely serious and deal with difficult things. But if you actually bring your fun side and your personality to it as well, I just think, well, again, why not?
Yes, yes. Oh, it's absolutely fabulous. I think it's great.
So kind. And
so we've already started talking about some challenges that you've had to overcome, Sarah. And we've talked about what happened when you were 18, which is quite a young age, even though legally you're an adult. That's a tough thing to deal with. Are there any other challenges that you'd like to share with us, including how you overcame them, Sarah?
I think, like everybody, I've had the odd knockback where somebody didn't get who I was. We talk about authenticity, and I'm in a sector, and I've been in this sector now for nearly 18 years. I'm in a sector where being a non-lawyer leader, a female leader, is unusual. So I've had the odd knockback because of that as well. And I think because I have brought my full self to work at times, and I haven't behaved the way people expect me to behave. For example, I remember people have said things to me like, your problem is you want to be in charge. And for a long time, mentally, I said, oh, that's a problem. I need to work on that. And then it took me a little while to turn it around and went, why is that a problem? So equally, I have had somebody say to me, you don't have the calmness of a leader, because I'm very gregarious and passionate and enthusiastic and everything else. But who says a leader has to be very clinical? I don't think that's the case. So I think what I've probably faced in different ways is elements of, dare I say the word, prejudice. I've faced some prejudice as well when I was pregnant, but that's another story. And I suppose what I've done is I've used it as rocket fuel. So, you know, I can't pretend I've had horrendous prejudice against me, but when I look back at it, there has definitely been some of that. And what I tend to do is become more determined. I remember one of my teachers at school telling me that I wasn't going to do very well in French, so I got an A to prove him wrong. So I've realized that sometimes if somebody sets me a challenge or gives me some adversity, I try and twist it around and use it to fuel me on. And the best way of dealing with that is to manage your own mindset, because we can control how we react to things, even if we can't necessarily control other people's views of us. And we should stay in our own lane and not get too hung up on what other people think about us. Accept the Marmite, embrace the Marmite. Some people are going to love us, some people are going to not. And that's okay, because we're all different. And if you try and please everybody, and you're going to stay neutral, So those of us that are driving change and trying to push things forwards are going to get some adversity. And I think use it as rocket fuel, embrace it, don't take it personally.
That is absolutely fantastic advice. In fact, this came up earlier this week. I had a lunchtime meeting with a leader within the nursing sector. And she was saying about this comparison challenge and also, you know, having to bend and shape to what other people expected. And I said, you will drive yourself mad if you try and do that, because you could do everything they expect and still get bad faith criticism. I mean, wouldn't you say, Sarah, that's often what happens anyway?
It is. And you're applying all of your energy to the lowest common denominator. What if you turn it around and surround yourself with your champions and your advocates and the people who give you energy? If you don't, you will be pulled down and pulled back, and just all that wasted energy. So I agree. We have to find coping mechanisms and ways of blocking it out. But working on your own mindset and controlling and working on your own reactions, I found, with the way I got through some of those actually numerous challenges over the years, just because of being different.
And there's no shame in being different, right?
No, I mean, it's an advantage.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, it's a superpower almost.
I definitely think so. I mean, without getting too political about it, because goodness knows there's a lot going on in politics at the moment, but I was very, very frustrated over the pandemic with some of the current government, and particularly with Boris Johnson at the start of it. And then I turned it around and actually started to feel quite sorry for him, because I thought, he's not had the gift of adversity that some of us have had to work through, which has made us better, stronger leaders. And I'm not saying for a second that I'm a perfect leader, and I will continue learning and improving, hopefully, for the rest of my life and the rest of my career. But actually going through challenges makes us stronger and better. And for somebody who's had an overly privileged background, put them into a tough situation, it's really hard for them to cope.
Yes, it really, really is. And you're right. You know, resilience is built from adversity. That's how we sort of strengthen that muscle of resilience, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. And so I try to look at it as a, you know, I haven't had the most horrendous life at all, but the challenges I have had, I look at them as a gift now. It's taken me ages to do that, by the way, but it's liberating when you do, utterly liberating.
It really, really is, Sarah. And I'm so intrigued by your day to day, Sarah, because you've been very, very humble, only really touching on your day job, which is a huge responsibility for a very highly regarded national firm. And you have multiple other roles that you do as well. I mean, would you like to talk a bit more about those other roles also?
Yeah, well, I'm so fortunate that I'm able to take part in a few other businesses. So, for example, I'm on the Council of the CBI. So I learn so much from listening and hearing from other business leaders in that. I'm a governor at Nottingham Trent University. I have learned huge amounts there about how to transform an organization and have fantastic governance. I'm the chair of a smaller organization, but very important, called We Are Radical, which is trying to even up the agenda for female entrepreneurs. And all of this just gives me a richness of different experience, which means I can bring it into the, if you like, the day job. But then outside of that, I've obviously got the acting still going on, the directing, and I'm a mum and a wife in the middle of it as well. So I think busy is probably the phrase. But I don't actually feel busy. I just feel that I'm good at multitasking, and that I try and join things up as much as possible to get benefit from all of those different things, so that the whole becomes greater than the sum of the parts.
Yes, yes. I love that. And is there any such thing as a typical day for you then, Sarah, with all these different
parts?
There is.
But that's a good thing for me, because I think I would get quite bored if there was too much routine. What I have found, I mean, I'm talking to you from my garden shed at the moment, which became infamously HQ during lockdown last year. I'm finding I'm missing it if I'm not in it. So I am making sure now that I do get the odd day to stay put, run meetings from here, get some thinking time, get some recharging time, rather than hurtling around the country. And again, I think that's a lasting legacy from lockdown, is to accept that you don't have to push yourself out there all the time. And particularly with me having a national role, I mean, we've just announced a new business coming into our group in the southeast. So that's even more travel for me. So I'm trying now to, whilst I don't like routine, to build in time where I'm not traveling. And I think that's something that will stick with me.
Yeah, prioritization is an essential skill, isn't it, Sarah, as a leader? It's very important that we get that right.
And this is, you hear this said a lot, but it's something that's always resonated with me, about putting the oxygen mask on ourselves in order to help others. That is absolutely vital. And that was something that came home to me during the pandemic as well.
So do you tend to wake up early in the morning? Are you one of these leaders who wakes up at 5 a.m.?
Oh, I wish. I wish I could say to you, I got up at 5 and I eat muesli and do yoga and listen to calming music before I go out for a 10K run. No, I don't. I'm rubbish in mornings. So I'm more of a late night person, if anything. But what I do find is that a lot of my best thoughts come to me first thing in the morning. So I tend to get up and write them down quickly. I just scribble them very, very quickly. Obviously something's processed overnight, but no, I'm then scrambling around grabbing some food quickly before diving onto a Zoom screen looking semi-respectable. So no, I don't have a brilliant morning routine, and especially when the family are around or I've been trying to get the kids to school, you know, you've got all of that added complication in there as well. But late at night I always carve reflection time out, and like I say, I then process, I think, while I'm asleep.
Yes. So, and wellness is a very important thing for everyone, really, but even more so since this whole pandemic has started. What do you do around that to safeguard wellness?
Yeah, so carving that time out to not travel, I think, is a big thing for me now. One of the things I did last year, and I'm just about to start it again this year, is to set myself a walking challenge or a cycling challenge to do a certain amount of miles in a certain amount of time. And last year I did it as a tour of our business, which meant I had to do about 600-700 miles in 2.5 months. And most of that was walking rather than cycling for a number of reasons. Our business has got bigger since last year. So I've just realized it's more like 800 miles I've got to do now. So I'm going to have to raise my game to get this done before year end. So I like to set myself a challenge, because when you are busy, I think you have to give yourself something that forces you to keep doing. Well, I do anyway. So for me, setting myself a very public challenge means I get out there again, start spending more time in the fresh air. I'm lucky enough that I spend part of my week in Yorkshire, which is where my family are now based, and getting out into the fresh air, walking, seeing nature, being in the hills. I adore it. I absolutely love being in beautiful natural places. And that gives me a chance to recharge mentally and physically as well.
Yes. It's certainly being exposed to nature. It's very grounding. I find it quite humbling in some ways when you really marvel. Yeah,
so much. And of course, that's going to be here way longer than we are. But also, if you think about nature, I mean, this is quite a profound thing to say, really. And is, I think, a lot of what's happening to us at the moment is nature fighting back, and we need to listen to it. You know, whether it's the climate crisis or the pandemic, you know, what we are doing to the planet is not sustainable, and ultimately nature will win. It's been here far longer than we have, and it will fight back. And I think there is an element of fight back coming at the moment that we have to listen to. But I remember profoundly listening to the bird song during the first lockdown, and that really resonated with me, how almost nature was taking the planet back. A little bit.
Yes. No, I do remember that stillness and just enjoying the grounding effect of that. No, I love that. So for any of you listening who are thinking, gosh, I could really do with some more tips around just overall well-being and wellness, it is very important to follow the example that Sarah set around carving out that time. You know, it's an intentional thing to make sure that you have that thinking space and that you're not constantly frenetic and running around and rushing around frantically. It does have a bad effect on wellness overall. So, Sarah, I mean, the sort of meat of these podcasts, it is privilege and allyship, isn't it? So, and I know that you are incredibly passionate about these issues.
Yeah.
Can you tell us what your understanding of privilege is?
Yes, it's interesting. I've had a bit of an eye-opener on this. Until recently, I would never have said that I was a privileged person. Now, I appreciate I am now. I've kind of found privilege, but I didn't start my life as privileged. I'll come back to that, because somebody challenged me on that recently and it was a bit of an eye-opener for me. But my definition of privilege would be to say an advantage that you've been given rather than an advantage you've worked for. So I would definitely have thought it as something that you inherit rather than something that you obtain, if you like. But I've been challenged on that, because what I have, I sometimes forget that I am now very much in a position of privilege, because that's not where I came from. So I feel a huge responsibility to use it. The other thing where I was challenged recently, and I really took this on board, was I went to a session on white privilege. And I came out of that extremely upset, I have to say, because I hadn't seen or understood it before. And it affected me very deeply, because I've coming from the background, the social mobility, if you like, background, single parent family, council estate background I have, I genuinely never thought I had privilege. But I do recognise there is privilege from my skin colour, as much as I abhor admitting that and saying it. It really opened my eyes to the fact that tragically and sadly, we do still live in a world where the things that you see in somebody either help them, benefit them, or potentially are held against them. And I've really had my eyes open to this recently, but certainly my original definition of privilege would have been something that you've been given rather than something you've had to work for. I don't know if that makes sense, Funkei.
It really does.
It's something I'm really still trying to understand. I think I've got a certain level of understanding. I think all of us need to work harder to keep listening, keep hearing and processing and taking that depth of understanding further. But ultimately, we can never fully understand what it's like to walk in somebody else's shoes. As much as we want to understand it, we can't feel their lived experience, but we can do our best to listen and to take as much on board as we can. So like I say, I now recognise and accept I do have privilege, but for years I would have said I didn't.
Yes. And I think that to some extent that would apply to me as well, if I'm honest, Sarah. You know, I come from a very socioeconomically advantaged background. Yeah. And I went to private school and thought everyone went to private school. Yes. I mean, it's a crazy thing, right? That's your world. Yeah. So it can apply to so many of us.
Yeah, I totally agree with that, Funkei. I did a presentation on leadership at a international women's conference a few years ago, and several people came up to me afterwards. It's the first time I'd been persuaded to talk about my story, and somebody came up to me afterwards and said, what a brilliant social mobility example. And I swear to you, I had never once in my life thought I was a social mobility example. I'm just me, and I'm just doing what I do and getting on with it. So yes, if it's been your world and that's your normal, then that's exactly how we see things.
So. Yes. We don't put it into a category, do we? That's just our lives.
And gosh, I feel so strongly about this, about inclusion and diversity as a broader topic. We have got to stop putting people in boxes. It's our individual lived experience. You know, your lived experience is entirely different to mine, and we can't judge it based on what we look like. It's just not feasible. It's a totally different thing. I have a partner who's very dear to me, who I work with, who's from an Islamic background. And when he and I were talking, so we're different gender, different ethnicity, you know, different religion. And when he and I were talking, we have a huge amount in common in terms of our lived experience. But looking at us or reading about us on our CV, we'd assume we were very, very different. But actually, we were incredibly similar in terms of our cognitive processes and our lived experience. So we've just got to get past this. And businesses are putting people into boxes by thinking they are doing the right thing. They are creating an LGBT plus committee or a female committee or an ethnic minority committee. And what we are doing is excluding to try and create inclusion. We're just getting this totally wrong. So we have to bring people in and mix us all up, not separate us out. And I also don't want somebody being brought into a board or a meeting because of their protected characteristic and then only being asked about their protected characteristic. Bring them in to talk about business. Don't bring them in to talk about what it's like being gay in a law firm. You know, that's the only way we're going to change this is to stop separating people and constantly referring to the things that make us different. And sorry if I sound like I'm getting on my soapbox about this, but I'm starting to feel really strongly that well-meaning organisations are doing it the wrong way.
Yes, and it can, of course, backfire and lead to backlash and be counterproductive then in the longer term.
Absolutely. But the key to this is to level the playing field and treat us all as individuals. But we have to acknowledge the level playing field does not exist. And for years, I wanted it to exist because I didn't want to admit that it wasn't level. So the first step is admitting that it's not level and talking openly about it in the way we are now.
Yes. And this very nicely then leads on to allyship, which, you know, I'd love you to talk a bit more about what that means to you and some good examples, if you can give any, of how that's worked well.
Absolutely. So the first thing is that allyship has got to be an action, not a word or a well-meaning statement. So for me, it's all action oriented. There's no point saying you're an ally. So I think for a while, people thought allyship was saying, yes, we agree with you. No, it means you need to take some action and do something about it. And I talked earlier about listening. So certainly in my organization, I've set up various different mechanics for me to listen to people and hear. And one of the things that we did was we set up a reverse mentoring scheme to make sure that I am in touch with people in a different part of the organization as me, with different lived experience to me, and that we're listening. And not only do I do that, but the top 30 leaders in the group do that now, and we hope to keep expanding it. So set up the dialogue, get the listening, and make sure that we understand, but then kick that into action. So we make sure that what we're doing is trying to change things and move things and put different things into place as a result of it. The other thing that I'm doing is trying to amplify the voices where I can, to use my privilege that I've now admitted I have, to amplify other people's voices and to put that out there. But the most important thing we can do as leaders, if we're allies, is to call things out if we see things that are wrong. If we stand by, and I think there was a fantastic quote, and I can't remember it, but a Desmond Tutu quote that was, you know, circulating recently about passive allyship, or the equivalent is the equivalent of siding with the opposition. And I think that's spot on. So the biggest thing is calling it out. So I don't have a master plan other than to make sure I'm connecting in with people who are not like me, listening and understanding as much as possible, amplifying their voices, taking action when I see something wrong, and calling it out.
Sounds like a master plan to me, I have to say, Sarah. My goodness. For someone who claims not to have a plan, that's a really, really good plan.
But don't you think we can somehow sometimes get hung up with having, you know, huge initiatives and giving them trendy names, and then having, you know, a big project plan around it? And it doesn't have to be that simple. We have to bring this into what we do. Sorry, it has to be more simple than that. We need to bring it into simply what we do every day, rather than creating a separate plan. So I'm back to this thing about segregation again. To create inclusion, bring things in, don't separate them out. So, for example, ED&I has to be owned for me at the highest board in my organisation, because if we have a subcommittee, we've delegated it, and it's got to come from the top, and it needs to be part of what we do every day, and it needs to be part of the ongoing dialogue. So, yeah, as you can see, I am quite passionate about this, because I think we've waited generations and generations for the opportunity to drive real, meaningful change, and I think we have it now.
And what I love, though, is you're not only passionate, there's action behind it, Sarah.
Yes,
you know, it's you've given examples already. And so with all these efforts that are being made, and I'm talking specifically about the solicitor's profession and indeed the wider business world, why do you think it is that it sometimes goes so badly wrong, Sarah? Do you have any thoughts around that?
I think it's fear sometimes, isn't it? I think, and particularly in those groups who may see themselves as more privileged, I think for some of them, perhaps, who are, it must be quite a fearful place. So when I say this to certain demographic of men, and I'm going to use their words here, the men that describe themselves as pale, male and stale, and I say to them, I actually empathize with you and feel sorry for you, they say, well, we don't need any empathy and to feel sorry for us, you know, we know what we're all about. So they get very defensive very quickly. But actually, when I do get to talk to them and understand a bit more, there is a sense of fear that they're now going to be discriminated against. And I know certain people would say, well, there's been advantage out there for so long, but we're not going to make this right if we make a whole bunch of the population feel fearful that they are about to be discriminated against. So, and this isn't about taking privilege. It's not about taking something away from anybody. It's just about creating a level playing field, so we're all playing a fair game. So I think where it goes wrong is when people don't necessarily understand that and feel fearful. I also think there's a whole genre of people who are just too fearful to open up dialogue around ED&I for fear of saying the wrong thing. So they're well-meaning, but they're actually scared of saying the wrong thing. And I had a brilliant person talking on one of our podcasts last year, actually, where she said that people are fearful of always getting her name wrong, so they don't use it. She said, I'd much rather somebody said my name and get it wrong than be fearful to call me by my name. And there's nothing wrong with getting it wrong if it's well-meaning and you're intending, whether it's your name, whether it's saying the wrong thing. And so I think we've got to open up the dialogue so that people are not fearful, either that they're going to lose something or that they're going to offend somebody. And I think it's fear. I don't know if that's your perspective on it as well, but
Yes. I remember I wrote, it was a few years ago, because I was still working at Roche at the time. I did write a piece for the Times about the fear factor being a barrier. I did. And it was a slightly different examples that I use. But again, the underlying issue for me was fear of being left behind. I that week I'd met with a senior partner, male senior partner at law firm, you know, white man, who said he felt like an endangered species with everything. You know, so these are sorts of things that are going through the minds of the very individuals who hold the power, who we're trying to partner with.
And of course, being, people ask me if I'm a feminist, because this is the issue that I've spoken out about the most, I guess, really, is gender inequality. I call myself a peopleist, and I want to essentially give everybody the same chance. So, but a male colleague said to me, and it was said with really good intent. He said, all you're trying to do, Sarah, is remove my privilege, but it takes a while to get used to the fact. First of all, you have to acknowledge and accept that you've had privilege, and then you need to back yourself and have the confidence to know that you can still make it without being given a helping hand because of a set of characteristics you happen to have been born with. So I do think we have to have some empathy for the people who feel they might be losing out, because if we don't sort that bit out, we won't get the level playing field. In the same way with gender equality, we measure how women are getting to the top of the business, but actually we should be measuring whether men are comfortable operating at every level of the business and have the same advantages that we do in being, it being socially acceptable for them to take time out to look after family or have children, you know, do this, the care side of having children, or put as much into the childcare. And until that happens as well, we'll not get the full balance. So I think we're looking at things a little bit too narrowly at the moment, and I think we need to open the whole thing up and say, how does everybody get the same opportunities, whether it's to be senior or indeed not to be senior, if that's what you want.
Yes. And I suppose, you know, we both have being a mother of sons in common, and you know, I'm very, very conscious of that with Max, that I want to give him the freedom from some of the stereotypes that we often put on men, you know, to have certain types of gendered roles in society. And I'm sure you would feel the same way about your sons.
Oh, definitely. So my eldest, Josh, is the same age as Max. He's just started uni as well. As he was going through school 2 or 3 years ago, he used to come home and say he was really worried about his career because he thinks women have all the advantages. I think I spat my tea out at that point when he actually said it, but he did believe it, because in his world, he sees his mum, who's a chief exec, his dad or his stepdad has been the homemaker. And at school, he felt that the girls were doing better than the boys. He genuinely thought he was going to go out into the world of work and be disadvantaged as a man. Now, I'm sure that's not the case, but he was really thinking that about the age 14 or 15, actually.
Yeah, so we do need to be aware of all these considerations, don't we?
We do. So let's just treat everyone as an individual and, you know, play to strengths, bring out the best in everybody, and hopefully remove that fear factor that you spotted a few years ago.
So why is diversity and inclusion so important to you, Sarah? What is that all about, that drive?
There is something in me, you know, I've done work, as I'm sure you have, over the years, thinking about your values, thinking about what you stand for, you know, doing all sorts of psychometric testing and all sorts of other things. And if you kind of cut me in half like a stick of rock and saw the words that were through the middle of me, fairness and freedom are the two words that always, I can give you 10 values that matter to me, but when I pull them right back to root causes, I'll get to fairness and freedom. And it's that, it's this fundamental belief that we are all equal and that we should all have the same rights, the same opportunities, the same freedoms, and the same chances in life. And I can't tell you where that's come from, really. It's just innate. It's just there. And if I then try and get logical about it, I'd say because I fundamentally then believe that business, society, and indeed the world will be a better place for it. We'll all be happier, we'll be healthier, we'll all be more, you know, the wealth will be shared better, nobody will be drastically worse off, but many, many people will be better off. And why not? Why wouldn't you have a world like that?
Yes, that's such a wonderful, wonderful vision to have, Sarah. Honestly, it's been a real delight talking to you today. And I just wondered if, you know, there's anything else that you'd like to share with our audience that you don't feel you've done justice so far.
Oh, well, I'm sure I've rambled on about all sorts of things, but ultimately have the confidence to be yourself. And for those generations coming through, people like me, people like you, we've got your back is what I would say. You know, there are plenty of great people out there now who believe what I believe, what you believe, who are going to try and do our best for the generations that are coming through.
Oh, what a fabulous way to end. Sarah Walker-Smith, thank you very much again for joining us today.
Absolute pleasure. And thank you for everything that you and Max are doing.
It's my absolute pleasure also. And with that wonderful audience, lovely listeners, thank you so much for following us, listening, downloading, sending us feedback. We hear that some of you have been studying episodes of some of our discussions with leaders and using some of the examples in your day-to-day practice, both at home and at work. We could never have anticipated this when we started this podcast series last year. So thank you very much again. And I look forward once again to having yet another truly inspiring conversation with another fabulous leader, just like Sarah Walker-Smith. Thank you very much, everyone, and goodbye for now.